What's up? This is Jungle Boy Jack Perry, and you are listening to the Solar Monster Sound Drop.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered my home.
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Shout out to David, our boy Frost757 from the YouTube live chats. He was at a Comic-Con this weekend. He got that Jungle Boy shout out for the podcast. That was very cool. The roads are a little bit safer today. After Tammy Sitch got her bail revoked in court on Friday morning, after she was arrested last week for the drunk driving accident that killed a man back in March, she posted bond. She was back walking the streets. It was ridiculous. The Florida State Attorney's Office thought the same thing. They filed a motion on Monday requesting that she be ordered to pretrial detention as she posed a risk to the community, and the judge agreed. She was cuffed. She was led back to jail, but not before taking yet another smiling mugshot that she can add to her collection. And the state attorney released a statement saying a deadly driver will reside behind bars until her case is resolved. A serious threat to the driving public has been removed. She'll be arraigned at the end of the month. As I said on Twitter, I hope they check for tunnels, because I don't want some El Chapo shit going on here where she burrows her way out of there like she's Kevin Dunn or something, crawling through a tunnel of shit to get out on the other side where her boyfriend is waiting with the engine running and a fifth of Jack Daniels in the glove box. That woman is right where she belongs. Good news, though. My bail didn't get revoked, which means you get another podcast. This is episode 756 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 15th, 2022. You know, Audible continues to work with yours truly to bring listeners of the Sound Off something very cool. There is a new wrestling book out by Brian Solomon, no relation, called Blood and Fire, The Unbelievable Life Story of Wrestling's Original Sheik. That's Sabu's uncle. And he was a big box office attraction in his day. He was known for how violent he was in the ring. He used to run the Detroit territory, so he was a promoter as well. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the man himself. It isn't officially out yet, not until the end of the month, but you can pre-order the audiobook right now for free when you sign up with our link for a 30-day Audible trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/solomonster to sign up. Search for Blood and Fire, and you can pre-order your copy. Won't cost you a thing. You get the book free or any of a dozen or so other wrestling books they have on there. So go check that out, audibletrial.com/solomonster. I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers this week. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. You could always drop a dono if you want to on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the text link right there at the top of the page. I want to say thank you to Awesome Anthony Anguiano, who believes that The Dark Knight is the greatest movie of all time. The Dark Knight is my favorite movie of all time. I don't want to get into a discussion of the greatest, because then that's going to cause World War III, but I'm with you. I'm with you, Anthony. I love The Dark Knight. Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose-Cannon Lopez, James Hollywood Herrera, Big B Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Mean Matt Forbush, thank you for the nice words, brother. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Caleb Showtime, Lindley Thunderstorm, Edward Vary, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, Shin Superkick Akuma, and The Hacker, Joshua Edwards. Hopefully he'll get a nice little laugh out of that. Only he and I knows what that means. But thank you all. Means a lot to me to see that kind of support every week, and I do appreciate it. The match of the week came from New Japan's Capital Collision Show in DC last night, the main event. A fatal four-way for the IWGP United States Championship with Juice Robinson, who only a few weeks ago said that he would be leaving New Japan, had everybody fooled, only to then turn around and join Bullet Club and sign a new deal with the company. Wins the U.S. title over Jon Moxley, Hiroshi Tanahashi, and Will Ospreay. Great stuff from these four, and it's got me excited for the Forbidden Door show next month. One person who won't be walking through the Forbidden Door is Kota Ibushi. He might be walking through the exit door. And that is this week's top story. The drama that has unfolded with Kota Ibushi this week is pretty wild. And it's also really sad because it means we may have seen the last of Ibushi in a New Japan ring, and maybe any ring, for a very long time. He went scorched earth this week, said some things that are very much frowned upon in Japanese wrestling, and he's still spouting off, actually, even as of yesterday. He's still going off on social media. There were a lot of things said on Twitter that were translated to English, mostly by one person who put together some pretty good translations, but there was some question as to whether some of these tweets and messages that were being posted were really, you know, really meant what it appeared he was saying. Or was it being lost in translation? It was so out of left field. And Ibushi is an eccentric guy. It's not like he's not a little weird. But all of this just sort of came out of nowhere. To give some backstory first, Ibushi has been out of action since the G1 finals in October. When he missed the Phoenix Splash, he landed badly on his shoulder. Last year was not the best year for him, even though it started out on the highest of highs. You know, he won the IWGP title at Wrestle Kingdom. He only held the title for 3 months. And a few months after that, he got very ill with what was diagnosed as aspiration pneumonia. And he missed a few months. And per the Observer, those close to him said that he felt pressured to return in time for the G1, which he did, even though he wasn't 100% physically, only to then turn around and injure himself in the last match of the tournament against Okada. And at the time, New Japan posted a statement on its website that Ibushi had suffered a right anterior dislocation of the shoulder and joint lip damage, and they said that recovery is expected to take 2 months. Well, 2 months was not nearly enough time, and he claims he felt pressured to return for Wrestle Kingdom, but he was nowhere close to being ready to come back. And in March, they advertised him for the New Japan Cup, but again, he told them he wasn't close to being ready to come back, and they waited until just before the tournament began to pull him. So here we are now, 7 months later. 7 months after the injury, he still can only bench, I think, about 90 pounds. He used to be able to lift over 300 pounds, but his shoulder hasn't returned to normal strength yet. Him feeling pressured to come back early when he wasn't healed was the least of all the controversial stuff that he said. In one message, he said, "I'll expose all about the former cheater's goon and the sexually harassing bosses. From the company president's lies to his unreasonable power harassment this time. Get prepared for this. Tokyo Sports and TV Asahi also, I don't care." Cheater's goon refers to Takamichi Noku and Tai Chi being accused of cheating on their wives many years ago. The Tai Chi thing was news a long time ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, it's not new. If any kind of infidelity comes out, they treat that very seriously over there. You know, both men took big pay cuts over it. Tai Chi was even suspended for 2 months at the time. The stuff with Taka, that was within the last few years. I'm not sure why Ibushi would even bring that up. Although, from what I understand, he's had heat with Tai Chi for a while. He doesn't like him very much, which I guess I may have just answered my own question. But his main issue came with a man by the name of Kikuchi, who, depending on who you believe, either works in talent relations for New Japan, or, according to Meltzer, he works as a member of their live event staff. And he's not actually a part of management. I've heard a whole bunch of conflicting things about exactly what this guy's position and what his title is. Considering the nature of some of these messages, it sounds like Kikuchi is more than just the live events guy. He sounds like Japanese Johnny Ace. And Kikuchi reportedly threatened to fire Ibushi or have him fired after he made a public appearance at another wrestling show back in March. It was a Just Tap Out show on March 5th. And I guess Kikuchi did not approve or he didn't know about it in advance. Just Tap Out is Taka Michinoku's promotion. New Japan does allow its wrestlers to work their shows. And I guess Ibushi just made an appearance. I don't know if he was in the ring and said hello or if he was in the crowd. I don't know exactly, you know, what he did there. But that did not sit well with Ibushi when Kikuchi went off and threatened to fire him. And Ibushi called Kikuchi a little fat guy with curled hair. Those are fighting words. The most shocking thing that people ran with from his tweets was some vague reference to possible Yakuza involvement with New Japan. The Yakuza link to New Japan and Japanese wrestling in general, that was always a thing many years ago. I think there were rumors of it even dating back to when the company was first founded. But I don't know that that's the case today, in 2022. The problem is, the Yakuza stuff came from one person's translation of Ibushi's tweet and how he interpreted it. Because Ibushi was being kind of vague and cryptic without coming right out and saying, you know, whatever it was that he was trying to say. And then the person, I think, deleted the tweet and they apologized for it. They said, I shouldn't have put that up. But people went and ran with it anyway. So the story became top New Japan star accuses promotion of Yakuza involvement when in reality, we don't even know if that's what he was saying. I wish we had a direct line to Ibushi to clarify all this in plain English, but we don't. We're relying on random, you know, secondhand translations of things that already sound intentionally vague as it is. Like he's being cryptic on purpose. Is he alleging actual mob involvement with New Japan itself? Is that current? Is he referring to that from many years ago? Or is he referring to Yakuza involvement with Kikuchi, who he clearly doesn't like? Or is he saying that New Japan is behaving like the Yakuza and how they handle their business? We don't know. I mean, it's a serious accusation to throw around. There have been other promotions, you know, probably the most famous one being the Pride MMA promotion years ago was linked to the Yakuza and they couldn't get television after that. They were done. It turned that whole promotion toxic and it killed the company. So it's a serious accusation to make, but we don't know exactly what he was trying to say. And Ibushi was back at it again yesterday. He tweeted, I'm going to fight until the end. I won't yield to a lot like them. Hashtag one day you'll know. Hashtag feelings don't change. My take on this is this. This sounds to me like a man who is clearly, you know, in a position where he wants to be fired. He wants out. He feels that New Japan management has taken advantage of him or treated him poorly by trying to rush him back from an injury that he still hasn't healed from. And maybe he even blames them for it. If he wasn't feeling great going into the G1 and then he ended up getting hurt, maybe he holds a grudge against them for that. And he wants out of his contract. You don't wake up and post the things that he's been posting unless you want out. I said, scorched earth. He's going scorched earth here. This is not a man who's hoping to get an apology and a handshake. This is a guy who wants out. Now, is he telling the truth about how all of this has played out? We're getting his side of the story here. Or is he just swinging for the fences with the hope that they'll let him go? I don't know what to make of all this, but it's bad. It's very bad. You know, he spent years working for New Japan. I think maybe 5 or 6 years as a freelancer before he ever signed an actual contract with them, which was a big deal at the time because Ibushi, you know, he didn't like the idea of signing a contract anywhere. He's sort of a free spirit who floats around and does his own thing. So him making that kind of commitment to New Japan was a very big deal for New Japan at that time. Maybe he wants to become a freelancer again. You know, Ibushi turns 40 years old next weekend. This guy's been drinking from the fountain of youth. I hope he's not done. You know, Kota Ibushi is one of the best pure athletes in wrestling that I have ever seen. The man is incredible. Some of the greatest matches that I've seen in the last decade have involved Kota Ibushi. I hope he continues to wrestle, but it's hard to envision him wrestling in New Japan after this whole meltdown. Yeah, he's already removed all references to New Japan from his social media. From everything I've read, he's never had any interest in moving to the United States. And I would think that him going to AEW, which I see people saying, oh, just go to AEW, Kenny is there and the Bucks are there. And, you know, him going to AEW would probably cause some awkwardness. It could potentially cause some big problems with, you know, AEW and New Japan and their whole partnership if they did that. That would be very awkward. But he does have friends there. I don't know if that's something he would want to do. He had the chance to sign with WWE years ago after the Cruiserweight Classic and decided against it. It's probably the entire reason why he didn't win. He decided against going to WWE. Wisely. A wise choice indeed. He made the right move. One of my favorite stories, and I hope it's true. I don't know if it actually happened this way, but people swear that it did, and this is the way the story's always been told. Ibushi was shown in the crowd. He was standing next to Funaki at the NXT TakeOver show in Dallas in 2016. Supposedly, he went backstage at some point during the show, and he gave a high five to a big man who he didn't recognize. And that big man turned out to be Vince McMahon. And it was said to be really, it really upset some of the people backstage. I don't know that it bothered Vince. He may have gotten a kick out of it. He probably looked at him and go, who the fuck is this guy? But apparently it rubbed people the wrong way that were in the back. But that's Ibushi. He marches to his own drum. I hope this isn't the end for him. But every day where he makes more of these comments, it becomes harder and harder for me to envision a future for him in New Japan. Deadline.com broke the news late Wednesday, only a couple of hours before Dynamite went on the air, that Brett Weitz will be leaving his position as general manager of TBS, TNT, and True TV as part of the Warner Media merger with Discovery. That was a position that he was named to the very same month that AEW debuted on TNT. Although he had been with Warner for many years before that, he was very instrumental in the launch and the expansion over time of AEW on those networks. And, you know, he was a big ally for Tony Khan to have. And I said this on Wednesday when the news first broke. I was just browsing the initial five or six or seven comments that were under the article. And Deadline is like an industry rag, basically. You know, what the dirt sheets are to wrestling. Deadline is one of those, you know, very much plugged in outlets when it comes to the entertainment world. So you tend to get people in the comments section who are in that business, who are in that industry, who work for some of these networks. And it was comment after comment. I did not see one negative comment from anybody who supposedly, you know, knew him, worked at Warner or other television networks who chimed in, who had anything bad to say about this guy. In fact, they went the opposite way and said, this is a terrible loss for Warner and Discovery. And he'll land on his feet somewhere, and whoever gets him is going to be better off for it, and what a great guy. And it's rare that you find a television executive who cares as much as he legitimately cares about his employees and the people that he works with, and all these positive things about him. You would wonder, yes, it's a merger, and these types of things happen, but why would you let somebody like that go? why would you kill morale by letting go of somebody who people seem to genuinely enjoy working with and working for? So all around, this sounds like a terrible move to make. But they talked about how you know, great of a boss he was. AEW, you know, should be fine. Again, I've said before, I think in the grand scheme of this whole merger stuff, AEW will be okay. And they're cutting scripted programming. AEW doesn't really fall under that category. But if you're Tony Khan, that's the sort of thing you don't like hearing about. This guy's been around with you from the very beginning and has been a big friend and a big ally of yours and a big believer in what you do, and now he's gone, and who knows who he's going to be replaced with. You also don't like, if you're Tony Khan, hearing about MJF wanting to go to WWE. And this was sort of the other big story of the week. According to a report from Fightful Select, that's the way things appear to be leaning right now. Now, it's MJF. You naturally have to be suspect of any stories like this because this is the sort of thing you would expect him to want people to believe. And he's certainly been leaning into this a lot when he does interviews and stuff. And so part of it, you know, he does that on purpose, you know, in kayfabe. But Sean Ross Sapp insists this is not a work. He may end up staying right where he is and not going anywhere. But him feeling this way, this is a real story. He insists this is not a work. So let's take it back to the interview that MJF did with Ariel Helwani. Remember a few months ago, he did this. It was a great interview, too. I think they talked for an hour, and it was a really good interview. But there was a little bit of controversy coming out of it. It got him into some hot water. It was reported at the time that he and Tony Khan had a very heated conversation after that interview because MJF never got it approved. He never got the interview cleared with their PR department. And it's very likely they would have said, yes, absolutely, go talk to Ariel, no problem. But he never even bothered to tell them about it, and they found out about the interview after it had already happened or when it was live and in progress. I don't remember if it you know, aired live anywhere. And Tony Khan was said to be hot about it. Now it's being said that the whole experience soured MJF on a whole number of issues. Tony Khan is said to be over it. He's cool about it. It's water under the bridge. But MJF hasn't forgotten about it. And they report that his public sentiments about wanting to go to WWE when his AEW contract is up is not just how he feels in character, but it mirrors his actual feelings. And really, I mean, think about it. That is the beauty of the MJF character. You can never be sure what's real and what's not. He could be out there on live television with a mic in his hand, legitimately shooting every week on various issues that bother him, but people would just chalk it up to, that's just him being in character. He's just keeping kayfabe alive. Yeah, he is, but it could also be his real feelings. We just don't know. He's probably the only guy who can get out there and get away with it, and people are none the wiser. They just assume he's just, you know, playing a part. Now, 2024 is still a long ways off. That's when his contract is up, I think, at the very beginning of the year. In the interview with Helwani, he flat out said that he's not signing shit before his contract expires, unless he were to get some kind of an astronomical number thrown at him by Tony Khan. And even then, he's not sure he would sign anything. Now, that I don't believe. I think if Tony Khan offered him a small fortune to keep him, he absolutely would sign that deal. But it works in his favor the longer things drag out, because then you pit WWE and AEW against each other in a bidding war. Two companies, by the way, who stand to make a lot more money in the next couple of years when their TV rights come due. I know there's some question about whether or not AEW can get a raise or a big raise, and with the merger now, who knows what Warner might offer them, if anything. There's not a doubt in my mind that both companies are going to get more money. The question is how much more. WWE will probably end up getting a shit ton of more money. I think AEW will get a nice boost too. So it doesn't really benefit him to sign anything now anyway. That I agree with. Yeah, there's not a doubt in my mind that WWE wants MJF in their company. They would be fools not to. But Tony Khan would be an even bigger fool to not do everything in his power to keep this man. You know, he let Cody walk. He had the option to roll Cody's deal over another year, Cody and Brandy, and he didn't do it, for whatever his reasons were. If things get toxic between the two sides between now and 2024, maybe he does the same with MJF. If he feels like Cody apparently did, that, you know what, he wants to go somewhere else. I don't want somebody here who's going to be unhappy. I don't want to hold them hostage like WWE would do. So I'm going to let this guy go. I'm not going to make any kind of effort beyond what I've already done. And fine, he wants to go, let him go. Maybe if MJF has a similar option, that Tony Khan can roll it over for another year. Maybe he chooses not to. It could be that come January 1st, 2024, his deal is up and he's free and clear. You know, this is a man who is going to be AEW World Champion within the next 12 months. You guys have heard me map out what I would do as far as the, you know, the AEW world title and where it goes next and who beats who for the title when. I've mapped this all out, and every scenario that I've pitched, MJF within this next year ends up with the AEW world title. There is not a doubt in my mind that title will end up around his, unless there is some sort of big blow up between the two sides and they know he's leaving for sure, that title is going to end up on MJF. He has only scratched the surface of what he can do in that company. He has never even held a title of any kind. He's had a diamond ring, but that's about it. But I don't think MJF is a mark for the title. I think he's a mark for the money. And where I could see there being real frustration, if you believe that this is legit, and I know a lot of you are still going to insist, no, it's a work, I don't believe this. But let's assume for a second that it's legit, and it's not some sort of angle that's being engineered by MJF and Tony Khan. People said the same thing about Cody Rhodes, and look how that turned out. Oh, it's just a big angle. I wasn't sure myself, but people are still, some people probably still believe it is all an angle with Cody and Tony Khan. They're playing the long game. When Cody wins the WWE title, they think he's going to take it back to AEW with him. I'm sure there are people stupid enough to believe that. Some people just cannot be convinced. Some people are just so far down the rabbit hole, they cannot be convinced. But if this is legit, and I think it probably is, I don't think, you know, Sean Ross Sapp is going to be reporting it if he thought it was all just an angle and he was being played. I could see MJF watching all of these big names come in, like CM Punk and Bryan Danielson and Adam Cole and Samoa Joe, the list goes on, being brought into the company, some of whom you know are making a lot more money than what MJF must be making. Especially Punk. But it's got to be more than Punk, right? He sees this because MJF was a relative unknown when AEW began. People, if you were a real wrestling fan, you probably heard the name from the indies or from his time in MLW. But MJF didn't become a known commodity in wrestling, I mean, let's be real, until AEW started. That gave him the national platform to get himself over. The only reason he's as big of a star in wrestling as he is now is because of AEW, not any of the other promotions he worked for before AEW. He's looking at all these people probably making more than he is, thinking they're making bank. I'm not. I deserve a bigger piece of the pie. But he still has just under 2 years left on his deal. There probably is some real frustration there, which is why this Warner Discovery merger looms very large here. And how things go with this next round of television rights negotiations is going to play a very big role in how things go with MJF, among other names, because how much more money, you know, Tony Khan can get for the rights to Dynamite and Rampage is going to dictate how competitive he can be when it comes to wrestler salaries and what he can offer people, and how well he can compete with WWE for talent. They're all pulling from the same pool. The pool of wrestling talent is not as big as some people think it is, relative to other industries and other sports. Vince McMahon and Tony Khan, they're pulling from the same pool. You got to be competitive. And he has been. How competitive he can be, though, a year or 2 years down the road is going to depend on how those deals turn out. Do they get a new deal with Warner? Do they negotiate with other partners to leave and go somewhere else? Well, I mean, that only makes sense if they can get more money. Right now, they're pulling in about $40 to $45 million a year for their TV rights. If they stay flat and they make the same amount but no more, I mean, that isn't good. You want to grow. You want to increase. You want to get more money. But if they double or triple that, then that's more money that Tony can throw around when negotiating to keep people under contract when their deals come due. MJF's deal just so happens to come due at the very time that all of this negotiating on both sides in both companies is going to be taking place. This is why I said it was important for WWE to do right by Cody Rhodes when they brought him back. And so far they have. So far they have handled Cody Rhodes perfectly. And he is going to be WWE champion. MJF has a direct line to Cody. Cody himself has stated that certain AEW stars, without naming them, obviously, have reached out to him asking for advice. In fact, it might have been his own interview with Ariel Helwani after WrestleMania. Cody did a whole bunch of media interviews, and it might have been in the interview with Helwani that he made that comment. He said, I've had AEW guys texting me and reaching out to me to ask me for advice, and I give them advice. I don't think he's actively trying to steal people and recruit people over from AEW, but he's got a lot of friends who work in that company. And I don't doubt that they've already reached out to him asking for advice. He keeps in touch with a lot of them. I would be surprised if MJF wasn't one of those people. And if Cody says, hey, you know, they've treated me great. It's a lot of fun over here. They've done right by me. I can put in a good word for you. That could sway some people to make the jump. Cody is, he may be the first big name to jump from AEW to WWE. He will not be the last. There will be more like him, maybe not an EVP. I mean, that was a big coup that WWE pulled off. But there will be more. Absolutely. And even if Cody doesn't do all of that, all they have to do is put, you know, put on Monday Night Raw, if they dare, put on Monday Night Raw and see that he is positioned as one of the top three stars in the entire company right now. You know, the grass isn't always greener on the other side, but in this case, for MJF, it might be. A lot can happen in the next 18 months. It's pointless to make a prediction now about where he's going to end up. When we talk about the young pillars of AEW, MJF is the young pillar of AEW. You know, there was a show on Wednesday that had Jeff Hardy against Darby Allin in a first-time ever main event. The high point in the show, ratings-wise, was not Jeff Hardy against Darby Allin. It was not a segment with CM Punk. It was not a segment with any of those big names. It was a contract signing segment with MJF and Wardlow. That was the high point of the show. Not the first time that that's happened. As big of a deal as it was for Tony to lose one of his EVPs to the competition, I think it would be a devastating loss for them if MJF jumped over to WWE. This is different than the Cody thing. Cody came up in the WWE system. You know, even when he started AEW, he came in and he wouldn't shut up about WWE. He would take little jabs at them, the Triple H, the sledgehammer thing to the throne, the golden shovel spot. He was a WWE guy who went to AEW and then went back to WWE because he felt like he had unfinished business there. He didn't like the way things ended there. And now he's telling this whole story, which is a real story, but now they've incorporated it into the storyline that, you know, Dusty had the WWF title taken from him in Madison Square Garden all those years ago, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, whatever it was. And he wants to win the WWF title. He wants to win the title that his father had in his mind taken away from him. He said his dream was to win the title one day and hand it to his father and say, here, now they can't take it away from you. Well, his father is gone. He can't do that now. But it's still a goal that he has. So he probably always had it in his mind that at some point he was going to go back. Even as he was telling people, I'm a lifer. I can't ever imagine going back. In the back of his mind, I think he knew. One day, I'm going to go back. MJF is an AEW guy. He's not a WWE guy. There's creative freedom that he has in AEW and what he does and what he says that he wouldn't have in WWE. WWE also has a PG product. Can MJF, as we currently know him to exist, you know, can he work in a PG environment? Can that character I'm talking about, can he work in a PG environment? Absolutely not. There would have to be changes made. Not as he currently is. Absolutely not. Can a watered-down, diluted version of MJF work? Yes, of course it can. He's talented enough, he can make it work. It would be different. It wouldn't be as good. But he can absolutely be a major star in that company. Look, I've ordered Jack and Cokes at the bar that have too much ice in them and taste watered down, but I still drink them. I don't just spill them out. So yes, he can make it work. But if MJF does eventually end up there, everybody was so happy to hear Cody Rhodes using his Kingdom theme song when he came, you know, back to WWE. MJF would be able to use his current theme music as well, because it's not an AEW song. It's royalty-free stock music. That's why you sometimes hear me using it on my live streams on YouTube. MJF could show up on WWE television with the exact same entrance, just like Cody did. He should never change his music. It's too perfect for him to change it. Tony Khan announced that AEW will be coming back to Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York City sometime in the next few months. He didn't give a specific date. I would guess after All Out, probably in September, as they did last year. They put 20,000 people in the building. That's the biggest AEW crowd of all time. More people than they had even in the United Center when they were there for the CM Punk return last summer. And most of that was sold even before they announced Kenny Omega against Bryan Danielson for the show. Speaking of the biggest AEW crowd of all time, let me take you back in the Wayback Machine, all the way to last Sunday, episode 755. When I talked about the Forbidden Door coming to Chicago next month, I said if Tony Khan wanted to pick a different city for All Out this year, which he probably should, instead of running the Chicago market again so soon after, I would like to see them run their first show in Canada and bring All Out to Toronto. Well, on Wednesday, Tony Khan did an interview with TSN, and guess what he talked about? Bringing an AEW show to Toronto. Like clockwork. He said, hopefully travel restrictions will continue to ease and that it's far more manageable today than it was 6 months or a year ago, and hopefully soon they can get up to Toronto. So he didn't specifically say All Out, but it does sound like a very real possibility, and if they can get the logistics in order, I don't know if it's too soon of a turnaround to whip it up in the next few months, but it definitely sounds like Toronto could be a possibility, a very real possibility for All Out later this year. I said they could easily sell out the Air Canada Center, or whatever they're calling it now. I think it does have a new name. But I think they could easily sell that place out. I mentioned running the Sky Dome and scaling it down for maybe up to 30,000. Because they're not going to sell out the Sky Dome, but they could do the Nick Khan thing, right? That's the Nick Khan strategy in WWE going forward. They're going to do more stadium shows, even though they know they're not going to sell out all the stadiums, but they could fit more people in them. You know, all these NBA arenas and stuff. Once you put the stage in and everything, you're going to get the same number of people. It's always going to be 14, 15,000. You know, you run a stadium, you could fit 25,000, 30,000, 35,000 people in there if you're WWE, even for a B show. All right, we'll see how many people Money in the Bank has. They're going to be at Allegiant Stadium like they were for SummerSlam last year. Money in the Bank is... Yeah, Money in the Bank has become, I think, more than Survivor Series. It's become one of the big four events they do all year, but do I expect 50,000 people in the building for Money in the Bank? Fuck no. You know, could they have 30,000? Yeah, probably. So it's the same kind of thing. If they wanted to, I think they could probably do that with the Sky Dome. And I think that's doable, because for their first ever event in Canada... The novelty of it, absolutely. I think they could pack the people in there. But I forgot about Exhibition Stadium. That was the stadium where WWE put 60,000 people in the building to see Hulk Hogan against Paul Orndorff in 1986, which is what then led them to booking the Pontiac Silverdome for WrestleMania 3. They said, oh my goodness, we can fit all these people in the stadium. Vince McMahon wanted to go big or go home, and that's what led to WrestleMania 3 happening where it did. Now, I know they demolished Exhibition Stadium years ago. Now they have a smaller one in its place that hosts football and soccer games. It's expandable up to 40,000 seats. That might be a better option for them if they want to go big but not too big. Maybe Sky Dome was a little too ambitious. Maybe they could run that stadium instead. But whenever they run Canada for the first time, it'll be a big deal. I know they do pretty well up there in Canada, you know, ratings-wise. They have a lot of fans up there in Canada. I've said before, I think Canada and the UK have two of the most rabid, loudest fan bases in wrestling. They don't get the shows as often as we do here in the States. You run Canada, big show in Canada, for the very first time. I think even before announcing what the card would be, just like Forbidden Door, sold out without a single match being announced in Chicago. All right, and that's like their home market now. I still think you go to Toronto, you go to Montreal, you go to some of these places in Canada for the first time, and they'll do big business there. Now, Dynamite on Wednesday had some Owen Hart Foundation matches. Owen's family was in the building. They showed Martha Hart on camera. She was smiling. She was watching the matches. There was a photo from backstage of her with her kids, Owen's son, Oge, his daughter, Athena, all grown up. It was very weird seeing them at a wrestling show. It was very weird seeing them back in that wrestling environment, which, again, I think flies in the face of this idea that they all just hate wrestling and they swore it off after, you know, Owen passed away. Clearly, what they hate is WWE. It's not that they hate wrestling. It's not that they hate what their father and their husband did for all those years, and they want to just erase his memory and erase his legacy. They don't want to have anything to do with Vince McMahon and his company, which is completely understandable because, you know, there's a reason why Owen is not here. It's because he did a stunt on their watch, and it's understandable that they wouldn't want to do business with somebody like that. So it was weird, though, seeing them back in a wrestling environment like that. Martha is going to be a Double or Nothing. I wasn't expecting her to be on TV this week, shown in the crowd. I knew she would be there presenting the trophies, the cups, to the winners of each tournament at the pay-per-view. So that was kind of a surprise to see her there. But they had Jeff Hardy and Darby Allin. This was the big first-time ever main event that they promoted. You know, in the description I put up on YouTube, I called it a dream match. And I've said before, that gets thrown around way too much these days. There's a lot of quote-unquote dream matches. People say, oh, it's a dream match. And I'm like, no, it's not. The only reason I said that, I wasn't saying it's a dream match for me. Darby Allin, in interviews, said that Jeff Hardy is a dream opponent for him, which you can understand because Darby probably grew up watching Jeff Hardy in fucking diapers. He models himself after the guy. So for him, it was a dream match. For some fans, it might be a dream match. What it ended up being was a Demolition Derby stunt show. It was less a match and more of just a collection of stunts. And as far as the collection of stunts, it was a well-done collection of stunts because I was sitting there and I was cringing and wincing every time I saw Jeff Hardy take a big bump, when I saw Darby Allin come off the top of that ladder with a Swanton bomb onto the chairs at full speed. I just wanted to make sure that neither one of these guys died out there in the ring, which would have been horrible considering that Martha fucking Hart was sitting in the crowd. How terrible would that have been? Somehow they made it out of the match in one piece, relatively. It was a stunt show. If you look at it like that, it was a wild spectacle. If you were looking for anything more than that, if you were looking for wrist locks and toe holds and psychology and story, you were shit out of luck because there was none of that in that main event. But it was the wildest 10-minute match I've probably ever seen in my life. And I don't need to see it again. But the finish surprised me. I expected Darby to go over, and he didn't. Jeff Hardy stole the win. He crucifixed him over after taking his finish, which apparently had no effect on him because he crucifixed him over immediately and then didn't even sell the fucking move when he got up. Jeff just got up and he was celebrating. But you'll have people who say, oh, Darby Allin's 150 pounds soaking wet, so it shouldn't hurt anybody if Darby Allin lands on them. Okay, whatever. It's the guy's finish, though. I always say, respect the finish. So Jeff Hardy is moving on in the tournament. We also had Tony Storm one-on-one with Jamie Hayter, and Tony Storm got the win, so already having much more success in this tournament than she did in the Queen's Crown last year in WWE. Now, as announced on Rampage, Hikaru Shida, I forgot to mention, actually, Adam Cole beat Dax Harwood, so Adam Cole advances in the tournament. He will face, in the next round, he'll face Jeff Hardy. But as announced on Rampage, Hikaru Shida is out of the Owen due to what they said was an injury. Chris Statlander was named as her replacement. Chris Statlander will wrestle Red Velvet. Well, as it turns out, Shida is not injured. And she made that very clear in a couple of tweets that she posted as soon as the segment aired on TV. Shida went on Twitter and said, well, I already had 4 matches after the street fight, because the claim is that she got injured in the Philadelphia street fight a few weeks ago with Serena Deeb. So she tweets, I already had 4 matches after the street fight and just finished the Greatest Fighting Musical show, but I seem to have been injured. Japanese wrestling is nothing for them. I'm so sorry, and sorry couldn't be in the tournament too. I'm glad from my heart that Chris is in the tournament now, and I'm going to try to enjoy sudden holidays in Japan because it has been a while before I had. Be positive, she says. And that got a lot of people talking. Was it a work? Was it setting up her return angle? I saw some people trying to figure this out and say, well, maybe Mark Sterling, you know, smart Mark, fucked with her travel itinerary, and the storyline is that, you know, they intentionally made it so that she wouldn't make it back in time, and that's why in the segment on TV, Mark Sterling said the only fair thing to do would be to give Red Velvet a bye into the next round, and that's when Tony Schiavone said, no, no, Tony Khan has announced that Chris Statlander is going to be her new opponent. So they were trying to, you know, storyline-wise, justify this, and maybe it's all just part of some big angle that they're doing, and that is not the case. And what I found very curious was the comment in that tweet where she said Japanese wrestling is nothing for them. She didn't say anything about specifically men or women, man, you know, male or female. She said Japanese wrestling is nothing for them. And I couldn't believe when I saw that. Of all the companies to make a comment like that about, you're going to make a comment like that about AEW, the one major national company in this country that gives more of a platform to Japanese talent on both the male and female side than any other company in the entire country. You're going to say that they, you know, Japanese wrestling is nothing for them. The company that is literally working with New Japan Pro Wrestling on a fucking pay-per-view in Chicago next month. So what she meant by that, I don't know. She can't possibly mean what I think she means by that comment, but if she does, it was a stupid comment to make. Now, the next day, after all this controversy, her name was trending for hours on Twitter. She clarified that. This almost read like, okay, this got out of control, and maybe somebody from the AEW side got to her and said, you better put a statement out to kind of, you know, calm things down. I don't know if that's why she did this, but she posted a statement the next day. She said, after my Philadelphia street fight, a doctor check from AEW was required to participate in the Owen Hart Cup, and I couldn't re-enter the country in time. I'm so sorry to disappoint everybody. These difficulties sometimes happen with international talents. I feel healthy and never stop trying to improve. Please cheer for Chris while I do my best in Japan. Holy Shida will be back soon. So again, unless that was just her way of trying to smooth things over, here's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like she went back to Japan, couldn't make it back in time for the tournament. AEW announced a storyline injury, which was news to Shida, who said, I'm not actually hurt. But that, due to travel issues, she was not going to be in the tournament. And if that's the case, then AEW bears some of the responsibility here. You know, they've known for weeks about this tournament. If they knew that they needed her, she had already qualified. If they knew that they needed her for this tournament, they should have communicated that with her early enough for her to make sure she was back in time. That's the problem that you sometimes run into, and it's nice that AEW allows their talent to work independent shots, and the international talent can go back and forth, and they can go work in Japan and then come back. That's why people like Riho, you know, they disappear and then they come back, and they disappear and they come back. Yeah, WWE would never allow something like this. You sign a contract with them, it's an exclusive contract, right? Because that just screams independent contractor. You have to sign an exclusive deal, and you can't work anywhere else. Nothing says independent contractor like an exclusive deal where they tell you where to be and when. But anyway, the pitfall of that, though, is a situation like this. So if that's what happened here, then, you know, part of the blame, at least, if not a lot of the blame, falls on Tony Khan and AEW for not communicating to her, hey, we need you back in time for the next tournament match. But what this could potentially set up now, I don't know when Shida's going to be coming back. It sounds like she's going to be spending some more time in Japan before she comes back. They could turn this into an angle, though. And this could set up a match when she comes back against Jade Cargill for the TBS title. That's what I would do. I would think Shida against Jade for the TBS title would be a natural program coming out of this. Now, this Wednesday on Dynamite, we have Chris Jericho going face-to-face with William Regal. They're going to have a face-to-face confrontation in what is increasingly looking like may end up being maybe a blood and guts battle between a couple of the warring factions here in this company. Kyle O'Reilly takes on Rey Fénix in an Owen Hart Foundation match. Britt Baker takes on the Joker in an Owen Hart tournament match. Samoa Joe takes on the Joker on the men's side. Adam Cole faces Jeff Hardy in a semifinal match. Hangman Page gets a warm-up for Double or Nothing against Konosuke Takeshita, who has looked impressive in the couple of matches I've seen him have in AEW recently. He comes from DDT Pro. Really talented. CM Punk will be on commentary for that. So the match itself, I mean, it's predictable as all hell, but I think the match itself could actually end up being pretty damn good. And Wardlow will have to take 10 lashes from MJF. This was one of the conditions that MJF listed in his contract signing on Wednesday. They're recycling the same angle that he did with Cody Rhodes. Wardlow has to accept 10 lashes, and then he has to wrestle Sean Spears, I assume the following week, in a steel cage with MJF as the special referee. And then, if Wardlow wins that match somehow, he would get the match at Double or Nothing with MJF. Now, the Jokers. We're going to find out who the Jokers are in a few days. Who are the Jokers on Wednesday? I'm sticking to my picks that I mentioned on the streams. I think Claudio is my pick, Cesaro, on the men's side. And I'm going to go with Athena on the women's side, the former Ember Moon. So we shall find out. Now, here's the updated card for Double or Nothing in Vegas as it currently stands. CM Punk one-on-one with Hangman Page for the AEW World title. Wardlow against MJF, which we know is going to end up happening. Thunder Rosa defends her AEW women's title against Serena Deeb. And we're going to have the finals for both the men's and women's Owen Hart tournaments. On the buy-in pre-show, it's going to be Hook and Danhausen taking on Tony Nese and Smart Mark Sterling. And that's it. Obviously, more matches are going to be added, but you know, we're not that far out. We're 2 weeks out now from Double or Nothing, and we only have... how many matches is that, officially? Let's count the Wardlow match, because we all know that's going to happen. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but 5 official for the main show. So they have a lot of work to do over these next 2 weeks to confirm the rest of the card. There's a lot of names missing from this show. Unofficially, it looks like we're going to get a triple threat for the AEW Tag Team titles. Jurassic Express defending against Team Taz, Ricky Starks, and Powerhouse Hobbs. And the team of Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland. That's where I think Christian Cage costs Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus the titles and goes heel. And some sort of tag match, maybe a 10-man tag, with the Blackpool Combat Club, Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz taking on the Jericho Appreciation Society. Which I think then leads to a Blood and Guts match on an upcoming episode of Dynamite. Not going to happen at Double or Nothing. They're not going to put the two rings side by side, I think, just for that match. I think Wheeler Yuta, he's the odd man out. He doesn't really fit numbers-wise in all this. And also, I think he's going to be, if he isn't already, he's going to be in Japan anyway. I think he's already there for the Best of the Super Juniors. He's in the Best of the Super Juniors in New Japan this year. And that is running over these next 2 weeks. So I don't think Wheeler is even going to be in the country. So, unofficially, I think that's what the card is looking like, but, you know, we got the Young Bucks, Red Dragon. We don't know where any of these other people are going to fit in. I would find it hard to believe that the Young Bucks, or FTR, would have nothing to do at all at Double or Nothing, but as of right now, they don't. This week's podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. I've talked to you guys about the dangers of being too stressed out. But a lot of people are also burned out without even realizing it. If you've experienced the lack of motivation or fatigue, feelings of helplessness or being trapped, then guess what? You've been burned out. I know the feeling well. All the work I do every week, I'm constantly feeling burned out. I get to the end of the day, I just don't want to do anything. Even the things I usually get pleasure from sometimes, they don't appeal to me. I'm too tired. That's a problem. We associate burnout just with work. But that's not the only cause. It's time to prioritize yourself. And that's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. Just talking with somebody can help you figure out what's causing the problem. And what's causing the stress that you have in your life right now. What's causing all this? Right? A certain former world champion once said, "What's causing all this?" I told you a few weeks ago, I signed up with a therapist through BetterHelp because I wanted to get the full experience for myself and see how the whole thing worked, and because I have issues with stress and burnout also, and lack of sleep. And it's been a real help. You know, my therapist is always responsive when I send a message if I have a question about something, and, you know, the tips and the advice that she shared with me have been very helpful. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anybody on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. You won't have to wait very long. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Solomonster Sounds Off listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. That's BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. I know some of you have tried it. I know some of you have been thinking about trying it. Stop thinking and do it. You'll be glad you did. Raw on Monday was a show that started... I love, by the way, I'm talking about therapy, and we go right into the Raw review. I'm starting to draw a correlation here as far as why I needed to seek out somebody to talk to. We now talk about Monday Night Raw. But Raw was a show that actually started with some promise, and then it fell off as the show dragged on. That's pretty much the standard pattern for this show. There was no Roman Reigns on Monday Night Raw, our unified champion. And despite rumors to the contrary, Andrew Zarian of the Matt Men podcast reported this week that Reigns will not be taking an extended break soon from WWE. His speech at that live event in Trenton, New Jersey got a lot of people talking about a week ago. He did sign a new deal recently that will see him working fewer smaller market house shows, but he is still expected to be working pay-per-views and TVs. And that's all well and good, but he's also off the advertising for Hell in a Cell next month. They have taken him off the poster. They have moved Cody Rhodes front and center solo. He's got the poster all to himself now. And if he's off the next pay-per-view, then it stands to reason that he is going to miss some TVs as well. And therein lies the problem. You know, Meltzer added to this in this week's Observer. He said that his next title defense won't be until Money in the Bank on July 2nd, which is their next stadium show. So you would expect him to be there, of course, on that show. Right now, Drew McIntyre is not the planned opponent. I guess they're going to try to hold off at least until SummerSlam, maybe longer, if maybe the Cardiff show in September. That doesn't leave a lot of options for an opponent, but there's always my idea that I had pitched, which they could go with Randy Orton on a stadium show. Reigns against Nakamura, that doesn't feel big at all. But Reigns against Orton, that works. You know, Brock Lesnar is supposed to be back for that show. Watch them do Reigns and Lesnar again. Roman Reigns against Brock Lesnar at Money in the Bank. When Brock comes back, he should be kept far away from the bloodline. I think we get Lesnar and Edge at Money in the Bank or at SummerSlam. The last time they did that match was 20 years ago. Edge has even said when they wrote him off television in 2003 for him to go get neck surgery, there was a segment on TV where he was attacked by an unknown attacker. He thinks the plan was for it to be revealed as either Chris Benoit or Brock Lesnar because he was due to tag with both of them leading into No Way Out, but they wrote him off instead and he wasn't part of the match. It would have been one of them as the attacker when he came back, but by the time he came back a year later, they dropped the whole story. And by the time he came back, Brock had left anyway. He had just left the company. So maybe it was going to be Brock Lesnar, and they just dropped the whole thing when he bailed. But I know he wrestled Lesnar and Paul Heyman in a handicap match at the Rebellion UK pay-per-view in 2002. That may have been their last time in the ring against each other. That's 20 years ago. And Edge is getting the big push now with his Judgment Day faction, so I think Lesnar against Edge is going to be a program later this year. But in any event, the point is, there aren't a lot of good options for Roman Reigns. But he has been pulled from a whole bunch of shows, and that may be the new norm for him going forward. And good for him. You know, he's earned it. He's a big enough star now. He's had health issues in the past. He's getting older. I know he's got aspirations to do movies, as they all do, right? We saw Rock do it. John Cena's done it. Others have tried. They failed. I think Roman will do well in Hollywood, but he's not there yet. But the point is, if he can get himself a better deal where he doesn't have to work as many dates, again, especially with his health history, then more power to him. Good for him. I try to do the same thing. But I was in favor of unifying the titles. You guys know that. And I'm still in favor of the concept of having one world champion that can work both brands. But to unify the titles and put them on someone who is going to be making fewer appearances is insane. This is not something that they were blindsided by. They had to know either he had just signed a new deal and was working fewer dates, or they were negotiating on a new deal where he would work fewer dates, and they still put both titles on him. If that's the case, then they may as well just split the titles this summer and go back to business as usual. There is a way to make one unified champion work, even with two brands. This is not the way. So now you're going to have people say, oh, you see, Solomonster, you were wrong. You're going back on what you said you wanted. It's the self-fulfilling prophecy deal. We'll screw it up. We'll screw it up ourselves, and when it doesn't work, we can say, see, we told you it wouldn't work. We told you we need two champions. And then they can go back to the way things were before. One good thing that could come out of not having the top title around as much, or the top champion around as much, we saw this when Brock Lesnar had the title years ago. It might just force them to place a greater emphasis on their other titles, whether it be the women's title or the secondary titles, you know, for the men. Seth Rollins had a nice little run with his Intercontinental title defenses on TV a few years ago. I remember him headlining Raw many times with those IC title defenses. The title may not mean as much anymore when it comes to live event business, which, you know, I read that, and Meltzer's not the only one I've seen say that, and I guess the numbers support it. When you have a big enough name or a big enough attraction on the card, or maybe now they finally got to a place where they always wanted to be, it's the brand. WWE comes to town, and they're going to sell the same 6,000 or 7,000 tickets that they would, whether or not there's a world title defense in the main event. That makes me sad. I think that's actually an indictment, frankly, on the championships and how people view them, how much in low regard people view them anymore, as if it just doesn't even matter. And when your titles don't matter, then what's the fucking point? What are you fighting for? Evidently, they don't mean as much. I guess business on a lot of these live events, whether there's a champion title defense in the main event, apparently it makes no difference anymore. That's sad. That's very sad. But if Roman Reigns is going to be missing a lot of these shows, then it's time to either get the titles off of him or split them again. It's not what I want, but it would have been nice to know his schedule was being reduced before they went and gave him another title on top of the one that he already had. So after baiting people into thinking that they were doing a winner-take-all unification stip for the tag team titles at WrestleMania Backlash, and then backing out of it, Randy Orton and Matt Riddle were on TV the next night, once again bringing up wanting to do a unification. Meltzer said that they would be doing the match with RK-Bro and the Usos, but as of right now, they are not planning on actually unifying the tag team titles. And as we saw on Friday, the match is now official for SmackDown this week. There will be a match between RK-Bro and the Usos, but I can tell you right now, there will be no unification on SmackDown this Friday. They have a pay-per-view in 3 weeks with no world champion on the show. The second straight pay-per-view with no world title match. If they are going to unify those belts, it would be there. It would not be on a random episode of SmackDown. There will be some kind of a fluky finish. Roman Reigns, maybe he'll get involved for the DQ. And then they can run it back a second time. But this time they could do it inside the cell. Yeah, I was going to say, inside the cell, they have to give us a winner, right? They have no choice. There can't be any shenanigans inside the cell. Then I said, hey, dipshit, have you forgotten? Do you have a short memory? We had back-to-back years of main events inside the cell that ended with screwy finishes that gave us no winner. So that is no longer true. I can't even say that anymore about Hell in a Cell. At least in Hell in a Cell, you know you're going to get a winner. No, you're not. Hasn't stopped them before. But if they do it inside the cell, I do think the Usos unified those titles there. They do not do it on Friday. Otherwise, look, if they're not actually planning on unifying them at all, then what the fuck is the point of this? Why even bother doing the match? There's no point. Just don't do it. You already announced the match and took it away. Now you're going to announce the match again and not give us a finish. At some point, they have to unify those titles if they're going to keep promising this to people and they're going to advertise the match. I did like the RK-Bro Street Profits match on Monday, as ridiculous as it is to see them recycling the same three teams. It's a three-team division on Raw with Alpha Academy thrown in there. But I thought this was a fun match. Riddle accidentally took out Orton on a dive out to the floor, a rare miscommunication between the champions that ended up not meaning anything at the end since they won. So I wouldn't read too much into that yet. The spot where Riddle countered the Montez Ford frog splash into an RKO I thought was great. They dusted off the old Mean Gene interview platform for Kevin Patrick to interview Austin Theory. They do this every few years. Everybody got all excited about it on social media. Oh my God, they brought back the old school platform. This is great. Give it a few weeks, it'll be gone again. We've been down this road before. I mean, again, people have short memories here. I love the gimmick, and I said the first two times they did it over the years that they should keep it. It lasts usually 1 week, maybe two. And then it'll just disappear again. They'll get bored of it, and they'll go back to doing everything in the ring. So it doesn't mean anything. We got our first Judgment Day segment with Edge, Damian Priest, and their newest member, Rhea Ripley. The Judgment Day. That's what they're calling it now. It's not Judgment Day, it's The Judgment Day, which sounds ridiculous. Judgment Day sounded fine on its own. Now it's The Judgment Day. I don't know why that needed to be changed 1 week in. Edge chopped his hair off after the pay-per-view. He was out there sporting a new shorter haircut that makes him look 10 years younger. He looks so much better with this haircut. The best decision he could have made was cutting his hair. That hair was looking fried. You know, little side story here. The first time Edge cut his hair short was before his Hall of Fame induction in 2012. We got the first, when I say we, I mean me and Noah Mark and Brian Blade, it was WrestleMania weekend, we got the first look before anybody else did, and we weren't expecting it. You know, when we did Radio Row for WrestleMania 28, there were a few tables, we had one table, and they were going from table to table. We had no idea who we were going to interview. All I knew is that, okay, we're going to interview a bunch of WWE people. I wasn't told who. I just assumed it'll be some, you know, middle of the card guys. I mean, it's 6:30 in the morning. You really think the big names are going to roll out of bed at 6 a.m. just to do Radio Row? And we're sitting there, and that's when they trotted out Daniel Bryan and John Cena and Shawn Michaels and Edge. And I'm like, holy shit. And I see the PR person is like walking them over. And I have like 5 seconds to think of questions to ask these. And it wasn't hard for me to do because, I mean, you know, come on, it's me. But that was a blast. So Edge was one of the people that they brought over. And we're looking, we're going, holy shit, what happened to your head? It was jarring, you know, to see him with that haircut. And the first thing that Noah said to him was, did you lose a bet? And without skipping a beat, Edge looks at him and goes, no, did you? And then when we asked him, you know, why'd you do it? He said he didn't want to be one of those guys in his 40s with a ponytail. And he said that his hair was starting to look like one of those old troll dolls. Well, here we are 10 years later. That's exactly what his hair was starting to look like. He was looking like one of those fucking troll dolls. So here we've come full circle. Edge has cut his hair short again, and I think it works with this character. Him with the short hair and the suit. He referred to Damian Priest as the Punishment. I like that little nod to his old Punishment Martinez moniker. And he referred to Rhea Ripley as the Eradicator. You know, Rhea used to call herself the Nightmare. I think that would have worked just fine. I was waiting to see what the explanation would be for Rhea joining the group. I'm glad that she did, but now it's like, all right, well, what's she going to say on television? How is she going to explain this turn of events? She said that she saw Edge and Damian changing for the better and she wanted the same. She was tired of signing autographs at the airport and then seeing them end up on eBay the next day. She's done being used. I thought that was a lame excuse. I liked what Edge said next. better, which is that he pulled Rhea aside weeks ago and told her that Liv Morgan was holding her back. That's the excuse that Rhea should have given. Talk about how she has wasted the last 9 months of her career being held back by two different tag team partners. And it took Edge pulling her aside backstage to realize it. It took his wisdom, it took his guidance to set her straight and put her back on the right path. Because that's an explanation that people wouldn't have any problem believing. She has wasted the last 9 months of her career toiling away in tag team matches. She cared more about what the fans thought and didn't want to disappoint them, but now she sees that she did so at the expense of her own career. But no more. That would tie in with what Damian Priest said after he lost the U.S. title when he healed on the fans and he said, I was caring too much about what the fans thought of me. But I thought the whole, I won't sign autographs for you anymore stuff. That's just paint by numbers, you know, generic heel stuff that just, it sounded lazy. At the end, Edge made it clear that he's not done looking for new recruits. And as I look at this Raw roster, and I've gone through the Monday Night Raw roster, there's only three names that really jump out at me as potential new members of Judgment Day. One of those being Finn Balor. He could still go heel and join the group. Tommaso Ciampa has been attacking Mustafa Ali randomly for no apparent reason the last few weeks. He doesn't seem to have much of a direction right now. He is a heel now. I would give him probably the best odds, actually. If you said, who do you think is going to be the next member of Judgment Day? Ciampa probably would have the best odds, I would think. But there is one other name. It's not the name I would go with, but I do think it deserves an honorable mention in that there's a chance it could happen. And that other name is T-Bar. They have nothing for Dijakovic. They have nothing for him, other than a pink slip with his name on it very soon. He could talk about being abandoned by Retribution. He was part of a movement that he believed in, but they didn't believe in him. Now he believes in what Judgment Day stands for. You know, he could change his whole look up. Those are the only three on Raw that would make sense from that side. If Edge wants to recruit someone from NXT, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Edge goes to them and says, look, I want to bring up somebody from NXT. I have a name I would suggest. I don't know who he would go with. Might I suggest Fabian Aichner? He's too good to be sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. He's still a young guy. He's only 31 years old. He could benefit getting the rub from a star like Edge. Whatever their reasons were, they left him down there when they called up Walter and Marcel Bartel. Now, if they are planning on eventually bringing him up, and eventually they're going to put the entirety of Imperium back together, then that's fine. I don't get the sense that that's the case. I would suggest Aichner as a new member of Judgment Day if they want to go the route of plucking somebody out of NXT. Balor got a win over Priest by DQ when Edge ran in and gave him a spear. That was the first of three disqualification finishes on this three-hour show. That breaks down to one DQ per hour. I don't care if you can justify them making sense. You don't do three disqualification finishes on the same show. Then we have Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. Adam Pearce informs Sonya Deville that after an internal investigation into her actions as a WWE official, that she has officially been terminated from that position. She's back to just being a wrestler. Just like Cody, no longer an EVP, just back to being a wrestler. And then he surprised her by informing her that her opponent would be the returning Alexa Bliss, who walked out to a remixed version of her old music. It's like they fused her goddess theme with her female fiend theme. But she was dressed like the old Alexa Bliss. She was dressed like the goddess. She was carrying the stupid doll with her still because they've got dolls to sell on WWE Shop. But it actually makes sense. I will give them credit for this. The last vignette that we saw of Alexa with her therapist, those stupid segments that they aired and then she made one appearance and we never saw her for 2 months or 3 months after that. But that last vignette that we saw of her, the big culmination of all those therapy segments, the therapist gave her a replica Lily doll with the stuffing inside from the original and told her, you'll be cured as long as you carry it with you wherever you go. As long as you do that, you're going to be just fine. And then, of course, the first appearance she made was at Elimination Chamber, and she didn't have the fucking doll with her. Here, she was carrying the doll, but otherwise she looked and acted totally normal, so she's taking her doctor's advice. And she made short work of Sonya with Twisted Bliss and got the win in about 30 seconds. A long overdue character change for Alexa Bliss, but the Sonya Deville stuff is a great example of dragging a story out for way too long. This should have ended with Naomi beating her and her being fired at that point from her position. She had abused that woman for 5 or 6 straight months on television. That was the story they told. It was Naomi, and people wanted to see Naomi get her revenge on Sonya Deville for all the evil things and all the unfair things she had done to her. And they did the match on TV. I thought they were going to maybe hold off for WrestleMania. They did it on a random SmackDown. I think it was about a month or a month and a half before WrestleMania. Maybe longer. But when Naomi beat Sonya, that was the time for Sonya to lose her power. Either then, or again, if you wanted to do a blow-off match to the feud at WrestleMania. But either way, that's where it should have ended. And instead, they dragged it out for another few months. There was a backstage segment with Becky Lynch, Asuka, and Adam Pearce, where Pearce said that Asuka was more than deserving of a title match. Becky complained and said Asuka was having things handed to her, and Pearce pointed out that he wasn't handing her anything. Asuka would have to beat Bianca Belair tonight in the main event to earn a shot at the Raw Women's Championship. Another one of these championship contenders matches they've grown so fond of doing. And Becky Lynch, whether this was her own idea to work it into the promo or they told her what to say word for word, she said the most honest thing on this show in a very long time, and something that you have heard on this podcast before. She said,
beat the champion to be able to beat the champion. That doesn't make any sense.
Beating the champion in order to beat the champion. That doesn't make any sense. Thank you, Becky Lynch, for talking some sense and being the voice of reason here. Even they are self-aware about how stupid it is to constantly have these matches and beat your champions without the belt actually changing hands. They had Cody Rhodes challenging Austin Theory for the United States Championship with the idea that the American Nightmare might win the U.S. title. Oh, how appropriate it would be for the American Nightmare to be the U.S. champ. And you knew that Austin Theory was not losing the title so soon after he won it. You also knew that Seth Rollins was waiting in the wings. They may as well have put a little Seth Rollins cam in the corner of the screen since everybody was just waiting for the inevitable run-in. And they did not disappoint. They were having a good match when Rhodes hit the Cody Cutter, and we got a tight camera shot of Cody to block out everything around him so you knew what was about to happen. Seth Rollins attacked him from behind for the DQ finish. Our second disqualification finish of the night. He pulled him out to the floor, he rammed him into the top of the announce desk face first a few times, and then he gave him the curb stomp on top of the desk. This was one of those DQ finishes that at least made sense. Rollins is unhinged after losing twice now in a row to Cody, especially after the way that Cody beat him at Backlash. He used the tights, which is how Rollins tried to beat Cody, so Cody gave him a taste of his own medicine. Rollins wanted to take something away from Cody that he wanted, that being the U.S. title, and he achieved that. And that now gives Cody a reason to want Rollins back in the ring, even though he's 2-0 against him. That gives them a reason to run it back one more time. This time they could do it inside the cell. Remember the analogy I used last week, Triple H and Batista from 2005. Batista got 3 straight pay-per-view wins over Triple H to really establish him at the start of his run as the World Heavyweight Champion. 3 straight pay-per-view wins over Seth Rollins would make a statement that WWE is all in, no pun intended, on Cody Rhodes. And since Roman Reigns won't be on the show, I think Cody and Seth have to get the cell by default. I mean, unless they do RK-Bro against the Usos inside the cell too. What other match would really be deserving of the cell? And you see, this is why Hell in a Cell as an annual show sucks. This sucks. because there's no really personal issue right now. Not even Seth and Cody. It's not that personal. Seth is pissed because he got beat twice. There's nothing personal about that. There's no program, there's no feud, there's no match that rises to the level of doing it inside Hell in a Cell. You could also do it with Edge and AJ Styles if you want to, but it's the same thing. Do any of these matches really need to be inside the cell? No. But the name of the show, it's Hell in a Cell, so they have no choice but to put at least one of those matches inside the cell. That's always been my issue with this pay-per-view. This pay-per-view sucks. It needs to go away. They aired one of the Lacey Evans vignettes on Raw for the first time, which was curious because they've been airing them exclusively on SmackDown now for weeks. But it made sense after the show was over when Mike Johnson of PW Insider reported that WWE has moved Lacey Evans to the Monday Night Raw roster. All those videos on SmackDown for weeks and her coming out on TV last week to wave to the crowd only to move her over to Raw. Now, if you believe that these two shows have two distinctly different audiences, and some people do believe that, that means they have to re-air all of those vignettes and educate the audience all over again. Although I wonder, you know, how many people does that really account for? Like, how many people are there, and maybe you guys can chime in on this, how many people are there who watch Raw, but don't watch SmackDown, or who watch SmackDown, but don't watch Raw? I would guess there are more people who watch SmackDown, just because it's an easier watch. More people who watch SmackDown who don't watch Raw than the other way around. But I'd be curious to know what those numbers look like. I would still think that number has to be pretty low. The vast majority of people who are watching WWE are probably watching both. Not only is Lacey Evans now on Raw, but she is going to be a heel. Son of a bitch, they're actually doing it. Remember, I wondered on the stream last week, I said, this doesn't make any sense, them introducing her in a very heelish way when she came out on TV on SmackDown that week. I said, unless this is part of some grand swerve, and they're going to actually re-debut her as a heel. After all those vignettes, it's all a swerve, like the Kurt Angle Three Eyes vignettes when he debuted and everybody booed him and he ended up being a heel. He was the delusional, geeky, goofy heel. What a waste. This woman could have been a huge babyface. But I think they realize they have two babyface champions right now. They have Bianca Belair on Raw, they have Ronda Rousey on SmackDown. And neither one of them are going to be losing their titles anytime soon. Charlotte Flair is gone. That's what the broken arm story was for, to explain her absence from television. She and Andrade are getting married in a few weeks, so she's going to be gone for a while. And they realize they need heels. They need heels to challenge Ronda, and they need heels to challenge Bianca. That would be the better role for Raquel on SmackDown. I thought they kept her strong on Friday against Ronda in the open challenge, even though she lost. Ronda won with a roll-up. She didn't win by submission. You know, Raquel Rodriguez, it's only her second match on SmackDown. She's out there challenging for the championship in an open challenge. They could have easily had Ronda tap her out in the middle of the ring. Submit her with an ankle lock or an arm bar, and they didn't do that. She won by the skin of her teeth. Raquel looked dominant for most of that match. Anybody saying, well, they buried Raquel. They've buried, and I certainly hope nobody is, but anybody saying they buried Raquel on Friday, they know nothing about pro wrestling. Rhea Ripley should be Bianca's main rival this summer. I'd have Rhea bring the gold home to Judgment Day at SummerSlam, and then Bianca can chase to get the belt back. I really think the two of them can have some kick-ass matches together. So I'd like to see them go around the horn and go back and forth. But I'm not sure why they would move Lacey to Raw when they could have used her on SmackDown. If that's the plan, if they're going to turn her heel, you could have kept her right where she was instead of moving her over. So with 5 minutes left in the show, they rang the bell for Bianca Belair against Asuka. And with Becky Lynch at ringside, you knew how this was going to go. Becky was wearing what looked like a dead, mangled transformer on her face. I mean, I guess you could call them glasses. This went 3 minutes before Becky attacked Bianca for our third disqualification of the night. It's almost impressive, their level of consistency when it comes to delivering shitty finishes on their television shows. It's almost admirable. So it looks like we're headed for a triple threat with Bianca, Becky, and Asuka, which sounds great on paper. But three finishes like this is too much for one show. You know, AEW hates doing DQ finishes, and WWE loves doing DQ finishes. There has to be a happy medium between the two. On this show, and on the Backlash pay-per-view the night before, and again, actually, on NXT and SmackDown all week, they aired a commercial for Money in the Bank, with Cody Rhodes doing the narration. Cody was standing in the middle of the field at Allegiant Stadium where the show was being held. And he said something very interesting that I did not pick up on it during the pay-per-view on Sunday, but I did on Monday when they replayed it. And he said, the winners of the Money in the Bank match will win the chance to main event WrestleMania. Now that is something that they have never announced before. That's very different than what Money in the Bank has been every other year, where they talk about winning the briefcase and having up to a year to cash in on a championship match, you know, whenever they would like. You would think that maybe it was a mistake. But then they replayed it three more times, and it was no mistake. It was meant to be. It's not like somebody didn't watch the ad back and catch it, or Cody ad-libbed what he was saying. He said exactly what they wanted him to say. I'm thinking it's just their way of suggesting that, who, and this is a weird way of doing this, but I think it's just their way of suggesting that whoever wins the briefcases could cash in, become champion, and if they do become champion, they would potentially go on to headline WrestleMania. It's a very weird way of phrasing it, but I'm guessing that's all that really is going on here. They're not changing the rules of the Royal Rumble. It would completely negate the Royal Rumble. You know, if you win the Royal Rumble, then you go on to challenge for the title at WrestleMania. And also, why have Money in the Bank in July for the right to headline a show that doesn't happen until April? So I know some people were asking, and I got a couple of emails about this. What's going on here? Are they changing the rules? Nobody seems to know for sure because WWE hasn't clarified, but I'm going to say no. It's much ado about nothing. Sometimes trying to explain why they do the things they do is an impossible exercise. But no, I think this is much ado about nothing. On SmackDown Friday night, outside of the unification stuff and the Ronda Rousey match with Raquel Rodriguez that I mentioned, the only other thing of note was an injury angle they shot with Baron Corbin taking out Madcap Moss. He wrapped a chair around his neck. He picked up the Andre the Giant Battle Royal trophy that Moss won at WrestleMania, and he dropped the trophy. They said it's a 100-pound trophy, and he dropped the trophy down on the chair, tried to snap this guy's neck. They put a neck brace on him. They put him on a gurney. They took him out. Did you see the injury they announced? The big injury to Madcap Moss. It's fucking ridiculous. Neck contusion. He has a neck contusion. I said they love their contusions. The thing I'm hoping for, I don't give a shit about any of this. I don't give a shit about this whole Moss and Corbin thing. It's fucking ratings poison for me. However, I'm hopeful that the reason they did this, it is a cover to get Moss off television for a few weeks so they can bring him back with a complete makeover. New name, new music, new gear, new attitude, no more jokes, no more laughing, no more joke. Everything gone. Hit the reset button. All finished. That's the only good thing that could come out of this. If they did the injury angle to reboot the guy, then I'm all for it. Because if anybody is in dire need of a repackage, it is Madcap Moss. Now, Post Wrestling is reporting that WWE will be resuming live touring for the NXT brand around Florida starting next month for the first time since the start of the pandemic. It's going to be the loops, the old loops they were doing before in front of like 300 fans a night, 500 fans a night. This is good news because a lot of the people on this show can desperately use that ring time. They have so many people stockpiled down there, even still after all the cuts they've made. And unless they're on television every single week, they're not getting in front of live audiences. They've been trying, you know, we're seeing more clearly inexperienced talent on NXT, and they have that NXT Level Up show, but there's still a lot of people who are training and they're at the Performance Center and they're not getting out in front of people. You can't replicate that in an empty warehouse training all day. You've got to get out in front of the people and react to the people and see what works and see what doesn't. So this is good news. And keeping it in Florida, I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense. You're not going to take that NXT brand touring on the road and go all around the country. Can you imagine the crowds they would do with these NXT shows doing live events with the... It would die a death. Keep it local. You run those local shows exactly as they were doing before. That's what makes the most sense. Now, NXT this week, like all wrestling shows right now, was smashed by the NBA and the NHL playoffs. Ended up doing the lowest rating in the history of the show on USA Network. For a show that was built mostly around the ladies. This was the first time ever that every single match on this show involved the women. Not since WWE did the Evolution pay-per-view 4 years ago has there been an entire show filled with nothing but women's matches. Now, one of the matches was a mixed tag, but that still counts, and the focus was mostly on the women in that match anyway. It was mostly on Saray and Tiffany Stratton. But... A lot of female representation on this show, and really it carried over from the end of Raw the night before, even though it was a 5-minute segment. Raw on Monday ended with a women's match. It ended with Bianca Belair and Asuka and Becky Lynch getting involved, and so from a women's main event on Monday, they went right into a show on Tuesday that had a woman, well, two of them at least, in every single match, which is something that's not been done before. One of the few segments that did not involve the women, but I wish it had, it would have been a lot more interesting, was Joe Gacy in the ring with his druid friends to talk about abducting Bron Breakker last week. Yes, the NXT champion was kidnapped last week and left for dead somewhere. He had a sack over his head. You know, when I watch NXT, I watch it with a sack over my head. I call it the sack of shame. Because if anybody were to walk into the room and watch me watching this show, I would be embarrassed. So that is how I watch NXT. I poke a few holes in the sack. I look like Jason Voorhees in Friday the 13th Part 2. When he had that fucking potato sack over his head. Nobody seemed overly concerned about the fact that the NXT champion was left for dead somewhere. The show just went on like it was a perfectly normal occurrence. Which, for NXT, I guess it is. People get abducted on this show all the time. This angle is WCW level bad. Like the filthy animals burying Ric Flair out in the desert bad. Funny thing about that angle, now that I mention it, that was a Russo special, in case that one wasn't so obvious. That was a Russo special. He was on Ric Flair's podcast years ago, the first one, I think. I mean, Flair's had so many of them by now, it's hard to keep track. I mean, his podcasts are like his wives. But Russo claimed that it was done, that whole angle with him being buried in the desert, he claimed it was done as a way to get Flair off television for a few months. His idea was, he was going to take all the legends, the Hogans and the Flairs and Sting and people like that, he was going to take all the legends, one by one, pick them off and take them off television, and then eventually reunite them like the Avengers. So on that podcast... I wish I still had the audio. Flair turns around and says, 2 weeks after you buried me in the desert, you called me to come back to TV because Terry Funk quit the company. So much for keeping Flair off TV for this great long-term angle. I wish WWE would bury this storyline in the desert. Gacy was out there. He blathered on about something while the fans tried to drown him out because they know this entire thing sucks. So they shouted and they tried to shut him up and he just went on. You know, the other problem with this is it's dragging Bron Breakker down as well. This does no good whatsoever for Bron Breakker. Him being part of this bullshit, I mean, this is the sort of thing that he should be kept as far away from as possible. But think about it. In a way, it kind of works. NXT is to prepare you for the main roster. Well, this is the kind of shit that you're going to get on the main roster. So Bron Breakker is just being conditioned for the shit that awaits him once he gets called up. So in a way, they are preparing him for the future. But I still say that he should be kept far away from this kind of crap. So from one kidnapping, we go to another. There is a war between Legado del Fantasma and Tony D'Angelo's crew. Last week, Legado kidnapped D'Angelo's consigliere, AJ Galante, threw him in a car, drove off. This week, they returned the favor and kidnapped Cruz del Toro from the NXT parking lot, which I have dubbed the Bermuda Triangle of wrestling because people are constantly disappearing from there. I mean, it is beyond parody at this point. If you park your car there, you're basically just asking for it. It's too bad Tammy Sitch never parked her car in the NXT parking lot. So later on, Santos Escobar, he calls D'Angelo on his cell. I guess he had his number for some reason. He calls him on his cell phone. And we got a cinematic split-screen conversation between both men about their mutual abductions. And D'Angelo agreed to release Del Toro if Escobar released Galante. And they agreed to settle the issue with a match. That's one way to set up a wrestling match, I suppose. Escobar said, "Hey, Tony, fuck you," which was bleeped, and he hung up on him, and D'Angelo flipped, and he, you know, flipped the table out, over out of anger. First, they kidnapped Raul Mendoza's name. Now they kidnapped Raul Mendoza. It's been a very tough year for the guy. Solo Sikoa was out for a promo to make it very clear that he wanted the next shot at the North American title after Cameron Grimes defends his championship against Carmelo Hayes at NXT In Your House next month. June 4th is the date. That's the night before Hell in a Cell. Sikoa was the most popular guy on the show by a mile. And when Grimes came out to confront him and agreed to give him the next shot, the crowd booed him. As soon as his music hit and he came out, they booed Cameron Grimes. For months, these fickle fuckers in the audience chanted for this man. They wanted so badly to see him beat LA Knight and win the $1 million belt. And he did. And then he got serious and he talked about winning the North American title for his late father. And they cheered. Now, a few weeks later, they boo him. And they chant, "You got lucky," at him after he won the triple threat match last week. Look, I understand they really like Solo Sikoa. But this is wrestling fans in a nutshell right here. What has this man done to warrant being booed? Nothing. He's done nothing. Yet they boo and they heckle him. These people are every bit as obnoxious as the fans at Full Sail were right before they left there. There was a backstage segment with Nathan Fraser being interviewed when he was interrupted by Zion Quinn. Then Wes Lee interrupted to set up another match between Lee and Quinn. I don't know if this is leading anywhere, but there was a brief interaction between Fraser and Lee. I think those two would make a great tag team. They share a very similar style, and if they're looking for a new MSK, I mean, not necessarily under that name, I think Fraser would fit the bill. The Creed brothers, they were still miffed at Roderick Strong for helping them beat the Viking Raiders last week, and so they're wrestling the Vikings again this Tuesday, and this time they want to win the match on their own. They don't want any help. They don't want any interference. Roddy then introduced them to the newest member of Diamond Mine, Damon Kemp, which is the name they gave to Gable Steveson's older brother, Bobby. And that was about it as far as the male involvement on this show outside of the mixed tag, which had Grayson Waller teaming with Tiffany Stratton to take on Andre Chase and Saray, which Saray won for her team. There was a backstage segment with Von Wagner also, but it's Von Wagner and I just can't bring myself to care. So we had the start of the women's breakout tournament. And the bracket looks like this. On the left side, we've got Nikita Lyons. Calm down. Nikita Lyons against Santino Morella's daughter, Ariana Grace. As name changes go, that one's actually not bad. And Fallon Henley against Sloane Jacobs. On the right side of the bracket, we've got Roxanne Perez against Kiana James and Lash Legend taking on Tatum Paxley. I look at this bracket, and I have only one conclusion to draw. They're going to give us Lions and Legend again in the finals, aren't they? Aren't they? Lions beat Grace to advance, and Henley beat Jacobs to advance. They open the show with Toxic Attraction beating Roxanne Perez and Wendy Chu to retain the women's tag team titles. Mandy Rose was interfering, seemingly at will, interfering in this match. I would keep Lash Legend far away from the finals, and I would send Roxanne to the finals to face Nikita Lyons. They made it clear the winner of the tournament gets a match for the championship of their choosing, implying that they could go after the tag team titles if they want. I could see Perez winning. She's the underdog who pulls it out in the end, and she wins the entire thing. And I could see her then choosing a rematch for her and Wendy Chu to go after the tag team titles, and this time they win them from Gigi and JC. I mean, why not? The winners of the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic opted for an NXT Women's Championship match instead. So it only makes sense that the winner of the breakout tournament would opt for a tag team title match. But in these two matches that we had, the first two tournament matches here, nobody stood out. It was pretty standard stuff. It was a little rough, which is to be expected. They closed the show with Natalya in what is scheduled to be her final NXT appearance, taking on Cora Jade. Fun fact, Natty has been wrestling longer than Cora has been alive. Think about that. Cora lost. The idea, though, is that she gained just by hanging in there against a veteran like Natty, and when Natty locked her in the sharpshooter at the end, she passed out rather than tapped out. Even though she could have done a better job with it, you know, because one second she's, it looks like she's having a conversation with the referee. I don't know what they're talking about. They're talking, and then the next minute she's out cold. That could have been done a little bit better, but she's young, she's 20 or 21, she's got time to figure out all of the nuances. I thought the first half of this was pretty dull. The match picked up late. Natty thought that Cora tapped, and when the referee told her no, she passed out. She didn't tap out. Natty extended her hand to help her up, and the two of them hugged to close out the show. She had earned Natty's respect. They wanted Natty to work with Cora specifically because the company thinks that Cora Jade has got the cute girl thing going on that they think will attract young men to the show and boys to the show. This is how they book. This is really how they book the entire show. This entire show has turned into one giant thirst trap. And once they trap you, they kidnap you. This is NXT. If you have questions for the mailbag, email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You guys know the drill. Include your name, include where you are from, hopefully not the NXT parking lot, or I may never hear from you again. Luke, from Brisbane, Australia. Jon Moxley taking time off to seek help was a blessing in disguise as it gave us heel Bryan Danielson, who was great to watch, and now AEW has the Blackpool Combat Club. What are some great examples of blessings in disguises that you can think of that have had great benefits? That's a great question. And as I was thinking about this, I think the first thing that popped in my head was the back injury. Forcing Shawn Michaels out of the ring for 4 years. I think that was a blessing in disguise because had he stuck around during the Attitude Era, it would have made the Attitude Era that much more interesting. But I think there's a very good chance he'd be dead right now. I don't think he would have survived the Attitude Era if he was on the road every week, still, doing the things that he was doing. He was headed down a very dark road. And he may never have met his wife. As it was, he turned his life around, he came back, and look at the second half of his career. Look at the body of work that he was able to put together in the second half of his career. You could go and say that the second half of his career, match-wise and story-wise and all the work he did over those 8 years, is better than the first half. Not everybody would agree with that, but you could definitely make an argument for that. I mean, that just doesn't happen. And none of that happens if he doesn't take the time to go away and get himself cleaned up and get his head on straight. So his back injury was a blessing in disguise. I mean, you want to think of something a little more recent, Jimmy Uso tearing his ACL in the ladder match at WrestleMania 36. That was a blessing in disguise for his brother. You know, where at first it looked like it was a curse, because usually when your partner goes down, you end up going on ice with them until they're ready to come back. Instead, Jey Uso got the biggest push of his entire life And he proved that he could hang as a single star. That's where the whole main event Jey Uso run came from. Again, blessing in disguise. Peter from Riverside, did you hear about the incident that occurred with Alberto El Patron, and do you think he will ever bounce back and get it together? Yeah, I heard about it. Yeah, basically, for those who don't know, I mean, it wasn't much of an incident. In the pantheon of incidents that this man has had, this one's pretty low on the list. Basically, he showed up late for a show that he was booked for in Mexico. He was told to be at the building by 3 o'clock. He got there, I think, at 5 o'clock. And the promoter told security, don't let him in when he finally showed up. There's video of this. There's video of this whole thing. And of him basically saying, fuck this, and pushing his way into the backstage area anyway. And they couldn't have been too upset with him because he ended up wrestling on the show as planned. Now, they may never book him again after that. I don't know why they booked him in the first place. You book Del Dipshit on your show, you do so at your own risk. Luke from Maricopa, Arizona. If a DVD documentary were to be released for Bobby Lashley, how unfinished would it feel to not include his time in Impact Wrestling? How important was Impact for Lashley's career? Very important. Very important. That's where I turned the corner on Bobby Lashley. That was back during the period where I was still paying attention to and watching Impact on a weekly basis. I went to some of those shows. I went to some of those tapings at the Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Center. I was there front row when Lashley would come out and, you know, the American Top Team crew, and he was the Impact World Champion, I think, at the time. And it was the first time that Lashley really was able to show off his personality, and he had improved a lot. He had some good matches there at Impact, so it was really a turning point. He was a different performer when he came back to WWE than he was when he left, in large part because he kind of came out of his shell a little bit more and developed into an actual champion during his time with Impact. So, very important, I think, to Lashley's career story. Julius from the Bronx, what if AJ Styles made his WWE debut in the mid to late 2000s? Would he have been as successful as he has been since debuting in 2016? And how would the matches have been? Also, how different would WWE have been the last 6 years if AJ had stayed in New Japan? He would have been successful, just not as quickly as he was. You know, when he debuted, he had the big surprise Rumble debut. He had already been a world champion elsewhere in a couple of different promotions. He was a veteran. I mean, he was already a veteran by the time he came in. Probably one of the most well-respected guys in the business as far as his work. But he had that big Rumble surprise debut. If you're not a big name, they're not going to do that. You're not going to get that kind of spot. And then he wrestled, you know, back-to-back pay-per-view main events against Roman Reigns for the championship just a few months later. Then he feuded with John Cena the entire summer, and he beat him. And then he beat Dean Ambrose, and he won the WWE title. No way he would have had that kind of immediate success had he debuted in 2007 or 2010. You know, if he debuted any earlier than that, they would have had him wrestling for the Cruiserweight title. He would have been dead. He would have been dead in the water. The one negative to him debuting as late as he did is all the matches that we missed out on, you know, when guys like Undertaker and Triple H and Shawn Michaels, when they were still active. I mean, the match with Shawn Michaels would have been obvious. And so he debuted, and by that point, Michaels was done, Undertaker was basically done, Triple H was basically done. You know, they could have done the Triple H match, I don't know if it would have been any good, but, you know, comes in 5 years earlier. Those guys are 5 years younger, they're still active. You know, although he still, even then, he would have just missed Michaels. It would have had to have been late 2000s. You know, Michaels was still active at that point. But would AJ have been as big of a star? No, that's the trade-off. He went on to become a very big name. He wasn't as big of a name at that time. Maybe in TNA he was, but I don't know that overall people would have looked at him the same way as they did years later after the New Japan run. The New Japan run, I think, is really what solidified him, even more than the stuff that he didn't impact. If AJ had stayed in New Japan, then we would have missed out on some great wrestling matches during his run. We would have missed out on matches with Cena, Brock Lesnar, Daniel Bryan. But honestly, outside of that, not much would be different in WWE right now. The machine goes on. You know, if AJ didn't debut, the company would have existed exactly as it did. Alberto in Laredo, Texas. Hopefully not the Alberto. I know how you feel about Triple H's Reign of Terror, but what about Jeff Jarrett's? The dude made a separate company and made himself champion multiple times in his early years. Or in the early years of the company. Yeah, that was pretty bad too. Especially when most of his matches ended the same way with the fucking guitar shot. I'm like, I mean, those Jeff Jarrett main events in TNA were just overbooked. Hilariously overbooked. I wouldn't say the Triple H stuff was overbooked. It just got, a little ridiculous. He was so dominant and so boring to me. And there were at least a couple of different people who I think could have had a run. Even if Triple H ended up winning the belt back, they could have traded wins maybe back and forth. But they were going, kind of like what WWE is doing now with Roman, where they want to go with the dominant, longtime world champion. I just thought it made for absolutely boring television. And the Jeff Jarrett stuff, look, I was paying attention to what was going on. I wasn't watching Impact really full-time when he had those initial title runs. I came in a little bit later on. So I kind of avoided it because it didn't appeal to me. Jeff Jarrett, as a world champion of your promotion, I mean, that don't work for me, brother. That was kind of my attitude about it. So I would suggest that you had Impact fans, you probably felt the same way about him that I felt about Triple H in 2002, 2003, into the beginning of 2004. Michael from Durham, England, you brought up the Winged Eagle and the Big Eagle belts last week, and it got me wondering, what are your thoughts on the Undisputed Championship design? It's probably one of the most divisive belt designs from what I have seen online and talking with friends. Well, I thought the spinner was the most divisive. You're telling me the Undisputed is the most divisive. I thought the Undisputed title had a certain elegance to it. I was not a huge fan of it at the time. I was definitely more of an Eagle guy. But now, all these years later, my God, with some of the belt designs we've seen now, I would happily take back the Undisputed title. Happily. At the time, I wasn't a gigantic fan of it, but I thought it looked nice. It wasn't one of my favorites. It's still not one of my favorites. If I made a top five, it wouldn't be the top five. If I made a top 10, I'm not sure it would be in the top 10. But I didn't hate it. Kevin from Guatemala. I was born in 1995, so I didn't get to watch the prime Bret Hart era. And I know you're like his biggest fan, along with Punk and FTR. So I want to know from you, what Bret Hart matches would you recommend to somebody to get familiar with his career and to show how good he really was? Well, Kevin, you have come to the right place. And if you are not a Bret Hart fan, here are a few gems to get you started. I mean, I just jotted these down. It took me 10 seconds. And I'm not going to go with the obvious. I'm not going to go with all of the obvious matches. I would say to get you started here, I would start with the Saturday Night's Main Event match that he had back in 87 with Randy Savage, which showed how valuable he could be in the ring outside of being just a tag team guy. I think you should watch at least one Hart Foundation match. I would suggest the match with the Brainbusters that opened up SummerSlam in 89. I would definitely watch his match with Mr. Perfect at the King of the Ring in 1993. I would watch his title defense against the 1-2-3 Kid on Raw in July of 94. I think it may have been July 11th episode. It's up on Peacock. And just watch how much he gave Waltman in that match. And he made people believe that this 170-pound kid might actually win the championship. I would watch his cage match with Owen at SummerSlam the month after that. It's the best cage match I've ever seen. Not an ounce of blood spilled in that cage match, and they still made it work. And I would watch his WrestleMania match with Stone Cold Steve Austin. It's a work of art. It's a reason why it's regarded as one of the greatest matches of all time. So that's a pretty good starting point. You get started on those, and then you hit me up, and you let me know what you think. Clark from Medicine Hat. Buy or sell on the better Ruthless Aggression era rivalry, Shawn Michaels against Triple H or Kurt Angle against Brock Lesnar? Ooh, that's good. That's a good one. I probably enjoyed the Angle-Lesnar matches more, but in terms of the overall feud, I would have to go with Shawn Michaels and Triple H. They had some pretty damn good matches too, but just in terms of the story and how far back the relationship went between the two of them, I would go with Michaels and Triple H. Ty from DC. What would you like to see happen more? Wrestling going back to its most popular peak or a World Series win for your New York Mets? Well, the Mets will eventually win a World Series again. In fact, I think they'll win one this year. But if wrestling was thriving with 5 or 10 million people watching every week and the television was consistently better than it is now, I would much rather have that. Because that would benefit me and my show and my business would be booming. Why wouldn't I want that? There's this misconception that, people like me and some of these podcasters right, thrive when WWE sucks, right? Because you could just rant about this, that, and the other. And it's such a fucking fallacy. Nobody wants WWE to be better more than me. I've been on here talking about it for 15 years, longer than most of probably your other favorite podcasters. I've been here talking about WWE for 15 years now. Nobody wants to be able to come on here and tell you about all the exciting, wonderful things happening on television more than I do. Instead of talking about, oh my God, here we go again with this bullshit and that bullshit, and I can't believe they did this, and this doesn't make any sense, and these people are stupid. What are they doing? What are they thinking? You think I enjoy that? You think I get pleasure out of that? I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I say the things that need to be said. I would love for them to figure out all of their problems and solve them and put on great television, great compelling television like they used to all those years ago. You know, if I had a heart rate monitor strapped to my wrist, as I do now, I have my watch on right now. If I was sitting in the crowd, as I did many times back in the late 90s, back during that Monday Night War period and wrestling was at its peak of popularity, and you strapped a heart rate monitor onto my wrist, I guarantee you my heart rate would be off the charts. I'd be in the 140, 150 range, some of those shows. It was that exciting and that fun. You strap one of these things around me now, if I were to go to Raw now and I would turn this on and check my heart rate, I would think I was dead. I'd probably have a heart rate of 50. I'd have to check my pulse and make sure I was breathing. That's the difference. I would rather have those days back. I want wrestling to be thriving in all companies, not just WWE, because then everybody benefits. But here's the other reason why I would rather have wrestling go back to its peak of popularity over the Mets winning the World Series. I spend way more time watching wrestling every single week than I do watching baseball. 52 weeks out of the year, I watch wrestling, I review wrestling, I talk about wrestling. There's no off-season for wrestling. So I would rather have that. Keep sending in those mailbag questions. We got some good shit this week. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. I have almost 60 questions from some of you guys to go through. Later today, I will do so. I will comb through the, last I checked, 56 questions that were left for me in that post I put up for our YouTube channel members. You guys are going to be getting an exclusive members-only Q&A video in these next few days. That post went up days ago. Again, that's for channel members only. It's one of the perks you get. If you would like to consider becoming a channel member, that's different than being a subscriber. If you want to become a channel member on YouTube, go to the YouTube page, click the join button. It'll give you all the details there, and you can make up your mind. So if you are a channel member, watch for that. I got a lot I want to get to this week. I got to do that video. It's been 2 weeks. I got to bang out the next Sound Off Gamer. I've been so busy. I have to get back to the My Rise mode. Solomonster, he's been nursing an injury. He rolled his ankle. So he's been taking it a little easy the last couple of weeks. But we got to get Solomonster cleared. We got to get him back in the ring. And hopefully we'll do that this week. I'm going to be back with you for episode 757. It's like our boy, Frost757 on YouTube. Episode 757 of the Sound Off next Sunday. And of course, live for the Dynamite stream coming up on Wednesday. I want to say thank you to David again, by the way, for that Jungle Boy shout-out. I have the video of the shout-out. I think I'll play that on the stream at the beginning of the stream on Wednesday night. So I will see you guys there. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. And I will see you back here next Sunday for more Sound Off, as always. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Everybody has to have something at the beginning of their theme. Drew McIntyre has the sword sound. Ricochet has the pew 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 pew. Moss has joke 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 joke. Boy, we've come a long way from the glass shatter. Do you smell what The Rock is cooking? Holy shit, what has happened to wrestling? What has happened to this fucking company? How did we get from that to this? This show is a joke 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 joke.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster Sounds Off.